man to do the right thing, to convince him that Mary is telling the truth and he is to follow through with the marriage. This is going to cost him. Do you know what he's going to endure if he marries a woman the whole community thinks is an adulteress? He will be shunned by his business associates and most of his clients. He will certainly lose his standing in society and perhaps even his place in the synagogue. To see the pain he's in for, notice the insult that the crowds will later use against Jesus. "Isn't this Joseph and Mary's son?" they say with a sneer and a nudge and a wink. In other words, "We know who you are, the bastard child of that slut and her foolish carpenter." Joseph will pay big time for this move. Does he withhold? No. He offers Mary his strength. He steps right between her and all of that mess and takes it on the chin. He spends himself for her. They will be called oaks of righteousness. Isaiah 61:3. There, under the shadow of a man's strength, a woman finds rest. The masculine journey takes a man away from the woman so he might return to her. He goes to find his strength. He returns to offer it. He tears down the walls of the tower that has held her with his words and with his actions. He speaks to her heart's deepest question in a thousand ways. Yes, you are lovely. Yes, there is one who will fight for you. But because most men have not yet fought the battle, most women are still in the tower. Most men want the maiden without any sort of cost to themselves. They want all the joys of the beauty without any of the woes of the battle. This is the sinister nature of pornography, enjoying the woman at her expense. Pornography is what happens when a man insists on being energized by a woman. He uses her to get a feeling that he is a man. It is a false strength, as I've said, because it depends on an outside source rather than emanating from deep within his center. And it is the paragon of selfishness. He offers nothing and takes everything. We are warned about this sort of man in the story of Judah and Tamar, a story that, if it weren't in the Bible, you would have thought I drew it straight from a television miniseries. Judah is the fourth son born to Jacob. You might remember him as the one who came up with the idea to sell his brother Joseph into slavery. Judah has three sons himself. When the eldest becomes a man, Judah finds a wife for him named Tamar. For reasons not fully explained to us, their marriage is short-lived. But Er, Judah's firstborn, is wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Judah gives his second son to Tamar, as was the law and custom of that time. It is Onan's responsibility to raise up children in his brother's name, but he refuses to do it. He is a proud and self-centered man who angers the Lord, so we put him to death also. You're beginning to get the idea here. Selfish men, a woman wronged, and the Lord is mad. Judah has one son left, Shelah. The boy is the last of his strength, and Judah has no intention of spending it on Tamar's behalf. He lies to Tamar, telling her to go back home, and when Shelah is old enough, he'll give him to her as her husband. He does not. What follows is hard to believe, especially when you consider that Tamar is a righteous woman. She disguises herself as a prostitute and sits by the road Judah is known to use. He has sex with her, uses her, but is unable to pay. Tamar takes his seal and cord and staff as a pledge. Later, word gets out that Tamar is pregnant. Judah is filled with what he insists is righteous indignation. He demands that she be burned to death, at which point Tamar produces the witness against him. See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. Judah is nailed. He more than recognizes them. He realizes what he's been doing all along. She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah. A sobering story of what happens when men selfishly refuse to spend their strength on behalf of the woman. But the same thing happens in all sorts of other ways. Pretty women endure this abuse all the time. They are pursued, but not really. They are wanted, but only superficially. They learn to offer their bodies, but never, ever their souls. Most men, you see, marry for safety. They choose a woman who will make them feel like a man, but never really challenge them to be one. A young man whom I admire is wrestling between the woman he is dating and the one he knew but could not capture years ago. Rachel, the woman he is currently dating, is asking a lot of him. Truth be told, he feels in way over his head. Julie, the woman he did not pursue, seems more idyllic. In his imagination, she would be the perfect mate. Life with Rachel is tumultuous. Life with Julie seems calm and tranquil. You want the Bahamas, I said. Rachel is the North Atlantic. Which one requires a true man? In a brilliant twist of plot, God turns our schemes for safety on us, requiring us to play the man. Why don't men offer what they have to their women? Because we know down in our guts that it won't be enough. There is an emptiness to Eve after the fall, and no matter how much you pour into her, she will never be filled. This is where so many men falter. Either they refuse to give what they can, or they keep pouring and pouring into her, and all the while feel like a failure because she is still needing more. There are three things that are never satisfied, warns Agur, son of Jacob. Four things that never say enough. The grave, the barren womb, land, which is never satisfied with water, and fire, which never says enough. The barrenness of Eve you can never hope to fill. She needs God more than she needs you, just as you need him more than you need her. So what do? Offer what you have. I'm afraid it won't work, a client said to me when I suggested he move back toward his wife. She's given up on me coming through for her, he confessed, and that's good. No, it's not, I said. That's awful. He was headed to a family reunion back east, and I suggested he bring his wife with him, make it a vacation for the two of them. You need to move toward her. What if it doesn't work, he asked. So many men are asking the same question. Work for what? Validate you as a man? Resurrect her heart in a day? Do you see now that you can't bring your question to Eve? No matter how good a man you are, can never be enough. If she's the report card on your strength, then ultimately you'll get an F. But that's not why you love her, to get a good grade. You love her because that's what you are made to do. That's what a real man does. My friend Jan says that a woman who is living out her true design will be valiant, vulnerable, and scandalous. That's a far cry from the church ladies we hold up as models of Christian femininity. Those busy and tired and rigid women who have reduced their hearts to a few mild desires and pretend everything is going just great. Compare their femininity with that of the women named in the genealogy of Jesus. In a list that is nearly all men, Matthew mentions four women: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Uriah's wife. That Bathsheba goes unnamed tells you of God's disappointment with her, and of his delight in these three whom he takes a notable exception to name in an otherwise all-male cast: Tamar, Rahab, and Ruth. Whoa, this will open up new horizons of biblical femininity for you. Tamar, we now know. Rahab is in the Hall of Fame of Faith in Hebrews 11 for committing treason. That's right, she hid the spies who were coming in to scope out Jericho before battle. I've never heard a women's group study Tamar or Rahab, but what about Ruth? She's often held up as a model at women's studies and retreats, but not in the way God holds her up. The book of Ruth is devoted to one question: how does a good woman help her man to play the man? The answer? She seduces him. She uses all she has as a woman to arouse him to be a man. Ruth, as you'll remember, is the daughter-in-law of a Jewish woman named Naomi. Both women have lost their husbands and are in a pretty bad way. They have no man looking out for them, their financial status is below the poverty line, and they are vulnerable in many other ways as well. Things begin to look up when Ruth catches the eye of a wealthy single man named Boaz. Boaz is a good man, this we know. He offers her some protection and some food, but Boaz is not giving Ruth what she really needs: a ring. So what does Ruth do? She seduces him. Here's the scene. The men have been working dawn till dusk to bring in the barley harvest. They've just finished and now it's party time. Ruth takes a bubble bath and puts on a knockout dress. Then she waits for the right moment. That moment happens to be late in the evening when Boaz has a little too much to drink. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits — good spirits is in there for the more conservative readers — the man is drunk, which is evident from what he does next: pass out. He went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. What happens next is simply scandalous. The verse continues, "Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down." There is no possible reading of this passage that is safe or nice. This is seduction, pure and simple, and God holds it up for all women to follow when he not only gives Ruth her own book in the Bible, but also names her in the genealogy. Yes, there are folks that'll try to tell you that it's perfectly common for a beautiful single woman in that culture to approach a single man who's had too much to drink in the middle of the night with no one else around the far side of the grain pile and tuck herself under the covers. They're the same folks who'll tell you that the Song of Solomon is nothing more than a theological metaphor referring to Christ and his bride. Ask them what they do with passages like, "Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit." Song of Solomon 7:7-8. That's a Bible study, right? No, I do not think Ruth and Boaz had sex that night. I do not think anything inappropriate happened at all. But this is no fellowship potluck either. I'm telling you that the church has really crippled women when it tells them that their beauty is vain and they are at their feminine best when they are serving others. A woman is at her best when she is being a woman. Boaz needs a little help getting going, and Ruth has some options. She can badger him. All you do is work, work, work. Why don't you stand up and be a man? She can whine about it. "Boaz, please hurry up and marry me." She can emasculate him. "I thought you were a real man. I guess I was wrong." Or she can use all she is as a woman to get him to use all he's got as a man. She can arouse, inspire, energize, seduce him. Ask your man what he'd prefer. Will you fight for her? That's the question Jesus asked me many years ago, right before our 10th anniversary, right at the time I was wondering what had happened to the woman I married. "You're on the fence, John," he said. "Get in or get out." I knew what he was saying. Stop being a nice guy and act like a warrior. Play the man. I brought flowers, took her to dinner, and began to move back toward her in my heart. But I knew there was more. That night, before we went to bed, I prayed for Stacy in a way I'd never prayed for her before. Out loud, before all the heavenly hosts, I stepped between her and the forces of darkness that had been coming against her. Honestly, I didn't really know what I was doing, only that I needed to take on the dragon. All hell broke loose. Everything we've learned about spiritual warfare began that night. And you know what happened? Stacy got free. The tower of her depression gave way as I began to truly fight for her. And it's not just once, but again and again over time. That's where the myth really stumps us. Some men are willing to go in once, twice, even three times, but a warrior is in this for good. Oswald Chambers asks, "God spilt the life of his son that the world might be saved. Are we prepared to spill out our lives?" Daniel is in the midst of a very hard, very unpromising battle for his wife. It's been years now without much progress and without much hope. Sitting in a restaurant the other night, tears in his eyes, this is what he said to me. "I'm not going anywhere. This is my place in the battle. This is the hill that I will die on." He has reached a point that we all must come to, sooner or later, when it's no longer about winning or losing. His wife may respond, and she may not. That's really no longer the issue. The question is simply this. What kind of man do you want to be? Maximus? Wallace? Or Judah? A young pilot in the RAF wrote just before he went down in 1940, "The universe is so vast and so ageless that the life of one man can only be justified by the measure of his sacrifice." As I write this chapter, Stacy and I have just returned from a friend's wedding. It was the best nuptials either of us have ever been to, a wonderful, romantic, holy affair. The groom was young and strong and valiant. The bride was seductively beautiful, which is what made it so excruciating for me. Oh, to start over again, to do it all over the right way, marry as a young man, knowing what I know now. I could have loved Stacy so much better. She could have loved me so much better as well. We've learned every lesson the hard way over 18 years. Any wisdom contained in these pages was paid for, dearly. On top of that, Stacy and I were in a difficult place over the weekend. That was the campfire. Satan saw his opportunity and turned it into a bonfire without even one word between us. By the time we got to the reception, I didn't want to dance with her. I didn't even want to be in the same room. All the hurt and disappointment of the years, hers and mine, seemed to be the only thing that was ever true about our marriage. It wasn't until later that I heard Stacy's side of the script, but here is how the two fit together. "Stacy, he's disappointed in me. No wonder why. Look at all these beautiful women. I feel fat and ugly." Me. so tired of battling for our marriage. How I wish we could start over. It wouldn't be that hard, you know. There are other options. Look at all these beautiful women. On and on it came, like a wave overwhelming the shore. Sitting at the table with a group of our friends, I felt I was going to suffocate. I had to get out of there, get some fresh air. Truth be told, when I left the reception, I had no intention of going back. Either I'd wind up in a bar somewhere or back in our room watching TV. Thankfully, I found a small library off to the side of the reception hall. Alone in that sanctuary, I wrestled with all I was feeling for what seemed like an hour. It was probably 20 minutes. I grabbed a book but could not read. I tried to pray but did not want to. Finally, some words began to arise from my heart. Jesus, come and rescue me. I know what's going on. I know this is assault. But right now it all feels so true. Jesus, deliver me. Get me out from under this waterfall. Speak to me. Rescue my heart before I do something stupid. Deliver me, Lord. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, the wave began to lift. My thoughts and emotions quieted down to a more normal size. Clarity was returning. The campfire was just a campfire again. Jesus, you know the pain and disappointment in my heart. What would you have me do? The bar was no longer an option, but I was still planning to just go straight to my room for the rest of the night. I want you to go back there and ask your wife to dance. I knew he was right. I knew that somewhere down, deep inside, that's what my true heart would want to do. But the desire still seemed so far away. I lingered for 5 more minutes, hoping he had another option for me. He remained silent, but the assault was over, and the bonfire was only embers. Once more, I knew the man I wanted to be. I went back to the reception and asked Stacy to dance. For the next 2 hours, we had one of the best evenings we've had in a long time. We nearly lost to the evil one. Instead, it will go down as a memory we'll share with our friends for a long, long time. Stacy has given me a number of wonderful presents over the years, but last Christmas was unforgettable. We'd finished with the feeding frenzy the boys call unwrapping presents. Stacy slipped out of the room with the words, "Close your eyes. I have a surprise for you." After a good deal of rustling and whispers, she told me I could look. Before me was a long rectangular box on the family room floor. "Open it," she said. I removed the bow and lifted the lid. Inside was a full-size claymore, a Scottish broadsword exactly like the one used by William Wallace. I had been looking for one for several months, but Stacy did not know that. It was not on my Christmas list. She had done this out of the vision of her own heart, as a way of thanking me for fighting for her. Here is what her note read. "Because you are a brave heart, fighting for the hearts of so many people, and especially for mine. Thanks to you, I know a freedom I never thought was possible. Merry Christmas." Chapter 11. An Adventure to Live. Dark and cold we may be, but this is no winter now. The frozen misery of centuries breaks, cracks, begins to move. The thunder is the thunder of the flows. The thaw, the flood, the upstart spring. Thank God our time is now, when wrong comes up to face us everywhere, never to leave us till we take the longest stride of soul men ever took. Christopher Fry. The place where God calls you is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Frederick Buechner. There is a river that winds its way through southern Oregon, running down from the Cascades to the coast, which has also wound its way through my childhood, carving a path in the canyons of my memory. As a young boy, I spent many summer nights on the Rogue, fishing and swimming and picking blackberries, but mostly fishing. I loved the name given to the river by French trappers, the River Scoundrel. It gave a mischievous benediction to my adventures there. I was a rogue on the Rogue. Those golden days of my boyhood are some of my most cherished memories, and so last summer I took Stacy and the boys there to share with them a river and a season for my life. The lower part of the Rogue runs through some hot and dry country in the summer months, especially in late July, and we were looking forward to kayaking as an excuse to get really wet and find a little adventure of our own. There's a rock that juts out over that river, somewhere between Morrison's Lodge and the Foster Bar. The canyon narrows there, and the rogue deepens and pauses for a moment in its rush to the sea. High rock walls rise on either side, and on the north, the side only boaters can reach, is Jumping Rock. Cliff jumping is one of our family favorites, especially when it's hot and dry, and the jump is high enough that it takes your breath away as you plunge beneath the warmer water at the top, down to where it's dark and cold, so cold that it sends you gasping back for the surface and the sun. Jumping Rock is perched above the river at about the height of a two-story house plus some, tall enough that you can slowly count to five before you hit the water. It's barely a two count from the high dive at your local pool. There's a faculty built in the human brain that makes every cliff seem twice the height when you're looking down from the top, and everything in you says, don't even think about it. So you don't think about it. You just hurl yourself off into the middle of the canyon, and then you free fall for what feels like enough time to recite the Gettysburg Address, and all your senses are on maximum alert as you plunge into the cold water. When you come back up, the crowd is cheering, and something in you is also cheering because you did it. We all jumped that day. First me, then Stacy, Blaine, Sam, and even Luke. Then some big hulking guy who was going to back down once he saw what the view was like from above. But he had to jump because Luke did it, and he couldn't live with himself knowing he'd cowered while a 6-year-old boy hurled himself off. After that first jump, you have to do it again, partly because you can't believe you did it, and partly because the fear has given way to the thrill of such freedom. We let the sun heat us up again, and then bombs away. I want to live my whole life like that. I want to love with much more abandon and stop waiting for others to love me first. I want to hurl myself into a creative work worthy of God. I want to charge the fields at Bannockburn, follow Peter as he followed Christ out onto the sea, pray for my heart's true desire. As the poet George Chapman has said, give me a spirit that on this life's rough sea loves to have his sails filled with a lusty wind, even till his sail yards tremble, his masts crack, and his wrapped ship runs on her side so low that she drinks water and her keel plows air. Life is not a problem to be solved. It is an adventure to be lived. That's the nature of it, and has been since the beginning, when God set the dangerous stage for this high-stakes drama and called the whole wild enterprise good. He rigged the world in such a way that it only works when we embrace risk as the theme of our lives, which is to say, only when we live by faith. A man just won't be happy until he's got adventure in his work, in his love, and in his spiritual life. Several years ago, I was thumbing through the introduction of a book when I ran across a sentence that changed my life. God is intimately personal with us and speaks in ways that are peculiar to our own quirky hearts, not just through the Bible, but through the whole of creation. To Stacy, he speaks through movies. To Craig, he speaks through rock and roll. He called me the other day after listening to Running Through the Jungle to say he was fired up to go study the Bible. God's word to me comes in many ways. Through sunsets and friends and films and music and wilderness and books. But he's got an especially humorous thing going on with me and books. I'll be browsing through a secondhand bookshop when out of 1,000 volumes, one will say, pick me up. Just like Augustine in Ephesians. Tole legi, take up and read. Like a master fly fisherman, God cast his fly to this cruising trout. In the introduction to the book that I rose to this day, the author, Gil Bailey, shares a piece of advice given to him some years back by a spiritual mentor. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and go do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. I was struck dumb. It could have been Balaam's donkey for all I was concerned. Suddenly, my life up till that point made sense in a sickening sort of way. I realized I was living a script written for me by someone else. All my life, I had been asking the world to tell me what to do with myself. This is different from seeking advice or counsel. What I wanted was freedom from responsibility, and especially freedom from risk. I wanted someone else to tell me who to be. Thank God it didn't work. The scripts they handed me, I simply could not bring myself to play for very long. Like Saul's armor, they never fit. Can a world of posers tell you to do anything but pose yourself? As Buechner says, we are in constant danger of being not actors in the drama of our lives, but but reactors, to go where the world takes us, to drift with whatever current happens to be running the strongest. Reading the counsel given to Bailey, I knew it was God speaking to me. It was an invitation to come out of Ur. I set the volume down without turning another page, and I walked out of that bookstore to find a life worth living. I applied to graduate school and got accepted. That program would turn out to be far more than a career move. Out of the transformation that took place there, I became a writer, counselor, and speaker. The whole trajectory of my life changed, and with it, the lives of many, many other people. But I almost didn't go. You see, when I applied to school, I hadn't a nickel to pay for it. I was married with 3 children and a mortgage, and that's the season when most men completely abandon their dreams and back down from jumping off anything. The risk just seems too great. On top of it all, I received a call about that time from a firm back in Washington, D.C., offering me a plum job at an incredible salary. It would be in a prestigious company, flying in some very powerful circles, making great money. God was thickening the plot, testing my resolve. Down one road was my dream and desire, which I had no means to pay for, and an absolutely uncertain future after that. Down the other was a comfortable step up the ladder of success, a very obvious next career move, and the total loss of my soul. I went to the mountains for the weekend to sort things out. Life makes more sense standing alone by a lake at high elevation with a fly rod in hand. The tentacles of the world and my false self seemed to give way as I climbed up into the Holy Cross wilderness. On the second day, God began to speak. John, you can take that job if you want to. It's not a sin. But it'll kill you and you know it. He was right. It had false self written all over it. If you want to follow me, he continued, I'm heading that way. I knew exactly what he meant. That way, headed into wilderness, frontier. The following week, 3 phone calls came in amazing succession. The first was from the Washington firm. I told them I was not their man, to call somebody else. As I hung up the phone, my false self was screaming, "What are you doing?" The next day, the phone rang again. It was my wife, telling me that the university had called, wanting to know where my first tuition installment was. On the third day, a call came from a longtime friend who had been praying for me and my decision. "We think you ought to go to school," he said, "and we want to pay your way." 2 roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Where would we be today if Abraham had carefully weighed the pros and cons of God's invitation and decided that he'd rather hang on to his medical benefits, 3 weeks paid vacation, and retirement plan in Ur? What would have happened if Moses had listened to his mother's advice to never play with matches and lived a careful, cautious life, steering clear of all burning bushes? You wouldn't have the gospel if Paul had concluded that the life of a Pharisee, while not everything a man dreams for, was at least predictable and certainly more stable than following a voice he heard on the Damascus Road. After all, people hear voices all the time, and who really knows whether it's God or just one's imagination? Where would we be if Jesus was not fierce and wild and romantic to the core? Come to think of it, we wouldn't be at all if God hadn't taken that enormous risk of us in the first place. Most men spend the energy of their lives trying to eliminate risk or squeezing it down to a more manageable size. Their children hear no far more than they hear yes. Their employees feel chained up and their wives are equally bound. If it works, if a man succeeds in securing his life against all risk, he'll wind up in a cocoon of self-protection and wonder all the while why he's suffocating. If it doesn't work, he curses God, redoubles his efforts, and his blood pressure. When you look at the structure of the false self men tend to create, it always revolves around 2 themes, seizing upon some sort of competence and rejecting anything that cannot be controlled. As David White says, the price of our vitality is the sum of all our fears. For murdering his brother, God sentences Cain to the life of a restless wanderer. 5 verses later, Cain is building a city. That sort of commitment, the refusal to trust God and the reach for control, runs deep in every man. White talks about the difference between the false self's desire to have power over experience, to control all events and consequences, and the soul's wish to have power through experience, no matter what that may be. You literally sacrifice your soul and your true power when you insist on controlling things. Like the guy Jesus talked about, who thought he finally pulled it all off, built himself some really nice barns, and died the same night. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Mark 8:36. You can lose your soul, by the way, long before you die. Canadian biologist Farley Mowat has a dream of studying wolves in their native habitat out in the wilds of Alaska. The book, Never Cry Wolf, is based on that lonely research expedition. In the film version, Mowat's character is a bookworm named Tyler, who has never so much as been camping. He hires a crazy old Alaskan bush pilot named Rosie Little to get him and all of his equipment into the remote Blackstone Valley in the dead of winter. Flying in Little's single-engine Cessna over some of the most beautiful, rugged, and dangerous wildness in the world, Little pries Tyler for the secret to his mission. Little. Tell me, Tyler, what's in the valley of the Blackstone? What is it? Manganese? Can't be oil. Is it gold? Tyler. It's kind of hard to say. You're a smart man, Tyler. You keep your own counsel. We're all of us prospectors up here, right, Tyler? Scratching for that one crack in the ground and never have to scratch again? I'll let you in on a little secret, Tyler. The gold's not in the ground. The gold is not anywhere up here. The real gold is south at 60, sitting in living rooms, facing the boob tube, bored to death. Bored to death, Tyler. Suddenly, the plane's engine coughs a few times, sputters, gasps, and then simply cuts out. The only sound is the wind over the wings. Little. Oh, Lord. Tyler. What's wrong? Take the stick. Little hands over controls of the powerless plane to Tyler, who has never flown a plane in his life, and starts frantically rummaging around in an old toolbox between the seats. Unable to find what he's looking for, Little explodes. Screaming, he empties the toolbox all over the plane. Then, just as abruptly, he stops, calmly rubbing his face with his hands. Tyler, still panicked and trying to fly the plane. What's wrong? Boredom, Tyler. Boredom. That's what's wrong. How do you beat boredom, Tyler? Adventure. Adventure, Tyler. Little then kicks the door of the plane open and nearly disappears outside, banging on something, a frozen fuel line, perhaps. The engine kicks back in just as they are about to fly into the side of a mountain. Little grabs the stick and pulls them into a steep ascent, barely missing the ridge and then easing off into a long, majestic valley below. Rosie Little may be a madman, but he's also a genius. He knows the secret to a man's heart, the cure for what ails him. Too many men forsake their dreams because they aren't willing to risk, or fear they aren't up to the challenge, or are never told that those desires deep in their heart are good. But the soul of a man, the real gold Little refers to, isn't made for controlling things. It's made for adventure. Something in us remembers, however faintly, that when God set man on the earth, he gave us an incredible mission, a charter to explore, build, conquer, and care for all creation. It was a blank page waiting to be written, a clean canvas waiting to be painted. Well, sir, God never revoked that charter. It's still there, waiting for a man to seize it. If you had permission to do what you really want to do, what would you do? Don't ask how. That will cut your desire off at the knees. How is never the right question. How is a faithless question. It means, unless I can see my way clearly, I won't believe it, won't venture forth. When the angel told Zechariah that his ancient wife would bear him a son named John, Zechariah asked how and was struck dumb for it. How is God's department? He is asking you what. What is written in your heart? What makes you come alive? If you could do what you've always wanted to do, what would it be? You see, a man's calling is written on his true heart, and he discovers it when he enters the frontier of his deep desires. To paraphrase Bailey, don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, because what the world needs are men who have come alive. The invitation in the bookshop, I must note, was given to me some years into my Christian life, when the transformation of my character was at a point I could hear it without running off and doing something stupid. I've met men who've used advice like it as permission to leave their wife and run off with their secretary. They are deceived about what it is they really want, what they are made for. There is a design God has woven into the fabric of this world, and if we violate it, we cannot hope to find life. Because our hearts have strayed so far from home, He's given us the law as a sort of handrail to help us back from the precipice. But the goal of Christian discipleship is the transformed heart. We move from a boy who needs the law to a man who is able to live by the spirit of the law. My counsel is this: live freely, animated and motivated by God's spirit. Then you won't feed the compulsions of selfishness. Legalism is helpless in bringing this about. It only gets in the way. Galatians 5, 16 and 23. A man's life becomes an adventure. The whole thing takes on transcendent purpose when he releases control in exchange for the recovery of the dreams in his heart. Sometimes those dreams are buried deep, and it takes some unearthing to get to them. We pay attention to our desire. Often the clues are in our past, in those moments when we found ourselves loving what we were doing. The details and circumstances change as we grow, but the themes remain the same. Dale was the neighborhood ringleader as a boy. In college, he was captain of the tennis team. What makes him come alive is when he is leading men. For Charles, it was art. He was always drawing as a child. In high school, what he loved best was ceramics class. He gave up painting after college and finally came alive again when, at age 51, he got it back. To recover his heart's desire, a man needs to get away from the noise and distraction of his daily life for time with his own soul. He needs to head into the wilderness, to silence and solitude. Alone with himself, he allows whatever is there to come to the surface. Sometimes it is grief for so much lost time. There, beneath the grief, are desires long forsaken. Sometimes it even starts with temptation, when a man thinks that what will really make him come alive is something unholy. At that point, he should ask himself, what is the desire beneath this desire? What is it I'm wanting that I think I'll find there? However the desire begins to surface, we pick up that trail when we allow a cry to rise from the depths of our soul, a cry, as White says, for a kind of forgotten courage, one difficult to hear, demanding not a raise, but another life. Edgar Lee Masters says, "I have studied many times the marble which was chiseled for me, a boat with a furled sail that rests in a harbor. In truth, it pictures not my destination, but my life. For love was offered me, and I shrank from its disillusionment. Sorrow knocked at my door, but I was afraid. Ambition called to me, but I dreaded the chances. Yet all the while I hungered for meaning in my life. And now I know that we must lift the sail and catch the winds of destiny, wherever they drive the boat. To put meaning in one's life may end in madness, but life without meaning is the torture of restlessness and vague desire. It is a boat longing for the sea and yet afraid." The spiritual life cannot be made suburban, said Howard Macy. It is always frontier, and we who live in it must accept and even rejoice that it remains untamed. The greatest obstacle to realizing our dreams is the false self's hatred of mystery. That's a problem, you see, because mystery is essential to adventure. More than that, mystery is the heart of the universe and the God who made it. The most important aspects of any man's world, his relationship with his God and with the people in his life, his calling, the spiritual battles he'll face, every one of them is fraught with mystery. But that is not a bad thing. It is a joyful, rich part of reality and essential to our soul's thirst for adventure. As Oswald Chambers says, "Naturally, we are inclined to be so mathematical and calculating that we look upon uncertainty as a bad thing. Certainty is the mark of the common sense life. Gracious uncertainty is the mark of the spiritual life. To be certain of God means that we are uncertain in all our ways. We do not know what a day may bring forth." This is generally said with a sigh of sadness. It should rather be an expression of breathless expectation. There are no formulas with God, period. So there are no formulas for the man who follows him. God is a person, not a doctrine. He operates not like a system, not even a theological system, but with all the originality of a truly free and alive person. "The realm of God is dangerous," says Archbishop Anthony Bloom. "You must enter into it and not just seek information about it. Take Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. The Israelites are staged to make their first military strike into the Promised Land, and there's a lot hanging on this moment. The morale of the troops, their confidence in Joshua, not to mention their reputation that will precede them to every other enemy that awaits. This is their D-Day, so to speak, and word is going to get around. How does God get the whole thing off to a good start? He has them march around the city, blowing trumpets for a week. On the seventh day, he has them do it 7 times and then give a big holler. It works marvelously, of course. And you know what? It never happens again. Israel never uses that tactic again. There's Gideon and his army, reduced from 32,000 to 300. What's their plan of attack? Torches and water pots. It also works splendidly, and it also never happens again. You recall Jesus healing the blind. He never does it the same way twice. I hope you're getting the idea, because the church has really been taken in by the world on this one. The modern era hated mystery. We desperately wanted a means of controlling our own lives, and we seemed to find the ultimate Tower of Babel in the scientific method. Don't get me wrong, science has given us many wonderful advances in sanitation, medicine, transportation, but we've tried to use those methods to tame the wildness of the spiritual frontier. We take the latest marketing methods, the newest business management fad, and we apply it to ministry. The problem with modern Christianity's obsession with principles is that it removes any real conversation with God. Find the principle, apply the principle. What do you need God for? So Oswald Chambers warns us, never make a principle out of your experience. Let God be as original with other people as he is with you. Originality and creativity are essential to personhood and to masculine strength. The adventure begins and our real strength is released when we no longer rely on formulas. God is an immensely creative person, and he wants his sons to live that way too. There is a great picture of this in Raiders of the Lost Ark, of all places. Of course, Indiana Jones is a swashbuckling hero who can handle ancient history, beautiful women, and a .45 with ease. But the real test of the man comes when all his resources have failed. He's finally found the famous Ark, but the Germans have stolen it from him and loaded it onto a truck. They're about to drive off with his dreams under heavy Nazi military protection. Jones and his two companions are watching helplessly as victory slips through their fingers. But Indiana is not finished. Oh no, the game has just begun. He says to his friends, "Get back to Cairo. Get us some transport to England. Boat, plane, anything. Meet me at Omar's. Be ready for me. I'm going after that truck." How? I don't know. I'm making this up as I go. When it comes to living and loving, what's required is a willingness to jump in with both feet and be creative as you go. Here's but one example. A few years ago, I got home from a trip on a Sunday afternoon and found the boys playing out in the front yard. It was a cold November day, too cold to be outside, and so I asked them what was up. Mom kicked us out. Knowing there's often good reason when Stacy banishes them, I pressed for a confession, but they maintained their innocence. So, I headed for the door to get the other side of the story. "I wouldn't go in there if I were you, Dad," Sam warned. "She's in a bad mood." I knew exactly what he was describing. The house was shut. Inside, all was dark and quiet. Now, let me ask the men reading this. What was everything inside me telling me to do? Run away. Don't even think about going in. Stay outside. And you know what? I could have stayed outside and looked like a great dad playing catch with my sons. But I'm tired of being that man. I've run for years. Too many times I've played the coward, and I'm sick of it. I opened the door, went inside, climbed the stairs, walked into our bedroom, sat down on the bed, and asked my wife the most terrifying question any man ever asks his woman. What's wrong? After that, it's all mystery. A woman doesn't want to be related to with formulas, and she certainly doesn't want to be treated like a project that has answers to it. She doesn't want to be solved. She wants to be known. Mason is absolutely right when he calls marriage the wild frontier. The same holds true for the spiritual battles that we face. After the Allies landed in France, they encountered something no one had planned or prepared them for. Hedgerows. Enclosing every field from the sea to Verdun was a wall of earth, shrubs, and trees. Aerial photographs revealed the existence of the hedgerows, but the Allies assumed they were like the ones found across England, which are 2 feet high. The Norman hedgerows were 10 feet high and impenetrable, a veritable fortress. If the Allies used the solitary gateways into each field, they were mowed down by German machine gunners. If they tried to drive their tanks up and over, the underbelly was exposed to anti-tank weapons. They had to improvise. American farm boys rigged all sorts of contraptions on the front of the Sherman tanks, which allowed them to punch holes for explosives or break right through the hedgerows. Grease monkeys from the States rebuilt damaged tanks overnight. As one captain said, "I began to realize something about the American Army I had never thought possible before. Although it is highly regimented and bureaucratic under garrison conditions, when the Army gets in the field, it relaxes and the individual initiative comes forward and does what has to be done. This type of flexibility was one of the great strengths of the American Army in World War II. It was truly Yankee ingenuity that won the war. This is where we are now, in the midst of battle, without the training we really need, and there are few men around to show us how to do it. We are going to have to figure a lot of this out ourselves. We know how to attend church. We've been taught not to swear or drink or smoke. We know how to be nice. But we don't really know how to fight, and we're going to have to learn as we go. That is where our strength will be crystallized, deepened, and revealed. A man is never more a man than when he embraces an adventure beyond his control, or when he walks into a battle he isn't sure of winning. As Antonio Machado wrote, "Mankind owns four things that are no good at sea: rudder, anchor, oars, and the fear of going down." I'm not suggesting that the Christian life is chaotic or that a real man is flagrantly irresponsible. The poser who squanders his paycheck at the racetrack or the slot machines is not a man. He's a fool. The sluggard who quits his job and makes his wife go to work so he can stay home to practice his golf swing, thinking he'll make the pro tour, is worse than an unbeliever. 1 Timothy 5:8. What I am saying is that our false self demands a formula before he'll engage. He wants a guarantee of success, and mister, you aren't going to get one. So, there comes a time in a man's life when he's got to break away from all of that and head off into the unknown with God. This is a vital part of our journey, and if we balk here, the journey ends. Before the moment of Adam's greatest trial, God provided no step-by-step plan, gave no formula for how he was to handle the whole mess. That was not abandonment. That was the way God honored Adam. You are a man. You don't need me to hold you by the hand through this. You have what it takes. What God did offer Adam was friendship. He wasn't left alone to face life. He walked with God in the cool of the day, and there they talked about love and marriage and creativity, what lessons he was learning, and what adventures were to come. This is what God is offering to us as well. As Chambers says, "There comes the baffling call of God in our lives also. The call of God can never be stated explicitly. It is implicit. The call of God is like the call of the sea. No one hears it but the one who has the nature of the sea in him. It cannot be stated definitely what the call of God is to, because his call is to be in comradeship with himself for his own purposes, and the test is to believe that God knows what he is after." The only way to live in this adventure, with all its danger and unpredictability and immensely high stakes, is in an ongoing, intimate relationship with God. The control we so desperately crave is an illusion. Far better to give it up in exchange for God's offer of companionship. Set aside stale formulas so we might enter into an informal friendship. Abraham knew this. Moses did as well. Read through the first several chapters of Exodus. It's filled with a give and take between Moses and God. Then the Lord said to Moses. Then Moses said to the Lord. The two act like they know each other, like they really are intimate allies. David, a man after God's own heart, also walked and warred and loved his way through life in a conversational intimacy with God. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him. But David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me?" The Lord answered, "Go, for I will surely hand the Philistines over to you." So David went to Baal-perazim, and there he defeated them. Once more the Philistines came up and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, and he answered, Do not go straight up, but circle around behind them and attack them in front of the balsam trees. As soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, move quickly, because that will mean the Lord has gone in front of you to strike the Philistine army. So David did as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer. 2 Samuel 5:17 through 20 and 22 through 25. Here again, there is no rigid formula for David. It changes as he goes, relying on the counsel of God. This is the way every comrade and close companion of God lives. Jesus said, "I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you." John 15:15. God calls you his friend. He wants to talk to you, personally, frequently. As Dallas Willard writes, "The ideal for divine guidance is a conversational relationship with God, the sort of relationship suited to friends who are mature personalities in a shared enterprise. Our whole journey into authentic masculinity centers around those cool-of-the-day talks with God. Simple questions change hassles to adventures. The events of our lives become opportunities for initiation. What are you teaching me here, God? What are you asking me to do or to let go of? What in my heart are you speaking to?" For years now, I've wanted to climb one of the great peaks, Denali perhaps, and after that, maybe even Everest. Something calls to my heart every time I see a photo or read an account of another attempt. The allure of the wild places we have left haunts me, but there's also the desire for a challenge that requires everything I've got. Yes, even danger, maybe especially danger. Some people think I'm crazy, and I know that this dream may never be realized in my lifetime, but that does not discourage me. There is something symbolic about the desire, and I cannot let it go. This is quite crucial for us to understand. We have desires in our hearts that are core to who and what we are. They are almost mythic in their meaning, waking in us something transcendent and eternal. But we can be mistaken about how those desires will be lived out. The way in which God fulfills a desire may be different from what first awakened it. In the past year or so, I've made a number of decisions that make no sense unless there is a God and I am his friend. I left my corporate job and struck out on my own, following a dream I've long feared. I've picked up the shattered pieces of a vision I lost when my best friend and partner Brent was killed in a climbing accident. What feels most crazy of all, I've opened myself to friendship again and a new partner, and we're heading out where Brent and I left off. The battle has been intense, a steep ascent that's taking everything I've got. The stakes I'm playing at now are immense, financially, sure, but more so spiritually, relationally. It's requiring a concentration of body, soul, and spirit I've never before endured. What is perhaps the hardest part is the misunderstanding I live with from others on a daily basis. Sometimes, the winds howl around me. Other times, I fear I'll fall. The other day, I was feeling way out on the end of my rope, cutting a pass across a sheer face of risk. Out of my heart rose a question. What are we doing, God? We're climbing Everest. Chapter 12. Writing the next chapter. I am sometimes almost terrified at the scope of the demands made upon me, at the perfection of the self-abandonment required of me. Yet outside of such absoluteness can be no salvation. George MacDonald. Freedom is useless if we don't exercise it as characters making choices. We are free to change the stories by which we live. Because we are genuine characters and not mere puppets, we can choose our defining stories. We can do so because we actively participate in the creation of our stories. We are co-authors as well as characters. Few things are as encouraging as the realization that things can be different and that we have a role in making them so. Daniel Taylor. Obey God in the things he shows you, and instantly, the next thing is opened up. God will never reveal more truth about himself until you have obeyed what you know already. This chapter brings out the delight of real friendship with God. Oswald Chambers. At once, they left their nets and followed him. Matthew 4:20. Now, reader, it is your turn to write. Venture forth with God. Remember, don't ask yourself what the world needs.
The following conversation is taken from a discussion with John Eldridge on November 7th, 2003.
While at Heart really came out of my own masculine journey. I don't write anything I haven't first lived because theory is not helpful. I mean, we have volumes and bookstores full of theory. But what I want to write is something that's authentic and has been tested in the fires of life. So Wild at Heart began in several ways, really. It began when I reached a crisis point in my own life, woke up in Washington, D.C. in 1990 and realized I hated my job. I hated my life. My marriage was in big trouble. And I had no clue on how to be the father of the boy that we had just had, and then obviously two more on the way. And so I began a journey. I went into Stacy one morning and I said, I have lost my heart. I don't know where and I don't know why, but I have got to go get it back. I have no passion for God, no passion for our marriage, no passion for our life, and I want to. I'm not leaving. I'm not walking out. I want to go together. And I know that something is deeply missing in my soul as a man. That was the start. Several other things intersected along the way. One was probably the most crucial was my friendship with Brent Curtis, with whom I wrote Sacred Romance. Because in the masculine journey, the deepest core need is for validation, that you are a man, that you have what it takes. And if we don't find that validation, we just look for it, you know, in our jobs and we become driven, right? Or we look for it in the woman, you know, and then we get into trouble in that area. Or we look for it in sports and, you know, we become the weekend warriors and, you know, but it never works. And, you know, you never find it in any of those places. The only place that you can find masculinity and find that validation is from another man. And so my friendship with Brent was just huge. We realized that we really shared something together, love for the outdoors. We used to fly fish and backpack and rock climb together, and a love of books. We talk about Julian of Norwich or Henry Nouwen or Buechner, Annie Dillard. And in the context of that friendship, these deep themes began to emerge in our own lives that we were looking for the same thing. We'd experienced much of the same thing, the father wound, you know, the desperate and empty search to find validation in the woman. And then Brent and I both were counselors, and what we began to realize kind of as the third stream into this was that every man coming into our office, no matter what his presenting problem, you know, whether he was there because they were going to get a divorce or he was there because he was addicted to something or he was depressed or suicidal, whatever it was, they were all the same, that the core was the same. Every guy I talked to was wounded. Every guy I talked to was desperate for someone to show him the way. And what we have now in our culture is an entire world of uninitiated men, men who have never been taken into the masculine journey and don't know how to get there. So Wild at Heart was born out of personal discovery. Here is the way, walk in it, as the scriptures say. And it was also written in an attempt to offer to men what they are not receiving in their world. They don't have another man to show them, you know, this is where you've been wounded. This is how you are a royal poser. This is, you know, and this is how to get out of that. Here's how to find the real deal. That was the genesis of the journey. And, I mean, we had no idea what it would touch, what it would unleash. I knew I had gold. I'm the man who found treasure in the field, and I've sold everything and bought this field. I really have. But I didn't know if others would recognize it as gold. I thought they might, but the response has been absolutely incredible. It's the most awesome thing in the world to see a man get his heart back get truly and deeply connected to God, not just go to church, but really have an intimate friendship with God and find in God the validation and the calling and the mission of his life. It's just huge. And then to also watch it happen with women, you see, is partly as a result of that. Was in Dallas just this last week, and at the end of a taping, some men who had been through Wild at Heart came to meet me, and they brought their wives. I thought that was really interesting. And wives were giving me these deep hugs, tears, you know. They just couldn't express enough how grateful they are that the man that they now live with is the man that they hoped for when they married, but the man that they did not have for 20 years. And then guys, I mean, just incredible stories of healing. Guy just wrote a letter to me saying that in Wild at Heart, he found the healing of an addiction, a sexual addiction that he had, and that he had been in counseling for 7 years and spent thousands of dollars to no avail because they weren't going after the right things. It's never about the addiction. It's always about the heart. The addiction is simply a symptom. The issue of the heart is deeper. And here this guy writes in and just says, thank you. I'm free. I'm whole. I found my strength. You know, I love those letters and could tell literally now thousands of stories like that. Men writing in and saying, for the first time in my life, and this guy might be 58 years old, for the first time in my life, I feel like a man. That huge question mark on my chest is no longer there. I know who I am. And incredible stories of healing, men who were abused as children. Man just told us his story that through Wild at Heart, he was able to recognize a wound that came in when he was molested as a young boy. And that part of his heart had been wounded and buried and forgotten for years. He just, like most of us, put it away, locked the door, suppressed it, you know. And through Wild at Heart, Jesus showed him his wound, but more importantly, met him there, healed his wound, and gave him his heart back. And tears, gratitude, you know, he's saying to us, my life has never been the same. I have never encountered God like this. So the response is more than we could have hoped for, but everything we wanted. 4 times a year here in Colorado, we do a Wild at Heart retreat for men. About 350 guys come out for 4 days. This isn't the quick sing a few hymns, have communion, and praise the Lord. It's a journey. I mean, it's in a lot of ways open heart surgery. And the men who have read Wild at Heart and have gotten tons out of it are absolutely blown away that there could be more, but there is more, you know. And to come through a live experience of the message and some deep soul work with God, to do that in a wilderness setting in Colorado that just allows the breathing room, no faxes, no cell phones, has been incredibly powerful for men, and men of all ages. I mean, it's just amazing. We have, you know, guys who are 18 coming, and guys who are 68 coming, and the response has been exactly the same. Whoa, had no idea this was available. You've taken me into depths with God and my heart and the masculine journey I didn't even know were possible. So if guys are interested in an experience like that, they can find that on our website, which is ransomedheart.com, and they get the information on where we hold them and why and how and how to get in, that sort of thing.
We hope you've enjoyed this audio version of Wild at Heart by John Eldridge. This audiobook has been produced and is copyrighted by Oasis Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.